What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
I was just having dinner in Wilmington, North Carolina, and I just found out that I won a Critics' Choice Award for Tammy Faye, and I am out of my mind with happiness. Thank you so much, you guys.
Jessica Chastain there, thanking the members of the Critics' Choice Awards who gave her their Best Actress honor last weekend for her performance in The Eyes of Tammy Faye. You're a critic, Josh. I don't know if you had a vote. Was Chastain your choice?
Did not vote in those awards. Do like that performance, but no, I don't think it made the top five on my CFCA ballot this year. Oscars, though, they did appreciate Chastain's performance there. She is a nominee for Best Actress. Those awards will be announced on March 27th. This week, it's our Oscars special, our picks for who will win, who should win, and who should have been nominated.
Do you think Chastain will be out of her mind with happiness if we pick her, Josh?
I'm sure it'll make it on the wall of fame she has in her house. That and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Josh, I know you're more of an NBA guy than a college hoops guy, but the Sweet 16 of any tournament is where things get really serious. Maybe a Cinderella or two makes the cut, but mostly it's the top seeds battling it out for madness supremacy, and so it goes with Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s.
Eager to hear if we have a Cinderella at this round. I'm not sure yet, so I'll find out shortly.
We do have to say congratulations to Blazing Saddles and to Monty Python and the Holy Grail for making the tournament interesting, busting a few brackets, but they do have their work cut out for them this week. Later in the show, we'll go over the round two results and share the Sweet 16 matchups. Also, Josh, you've got some golden brick spotting for us. Instead of watching all of the Oscar nominees, you decided to watch something from 2022. How dare you?
Yeah, I did a little homework. I did a piece of homework, but I had to turn the page a little bit too.
Okay, but first, it is time for our Oscar picks, six categories, and we need to acknowledge the Michael Phillips-sized elephant in the room.
Yes.
The great Chicago Tribune film critic who every year joins us for this and was scheduled to join us for this show. Unfortunately, had to back out last minute, a little bit of a scheduling conflict. He, of course, is eager to come back on, but this Oscar special on Film Spotting will be a little less star-studded.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm trying to think who has. We haven't really tabulated our predictions over the years between you, me, and Michael. Mm-hmm. We need one of those spreadsheets you love to do for like trivia spotting and the like. Uh-huh. I wonder if he has a better record than we both do making predictions. I'm going to guess yes.
I am going to guess yes as well. I'm 100% though on my picks for who should win.
Yes. You're very, very strong in that category.
Let's get into those categories. We start with the supporting performances and best supporting actor. We are going to tell you who will win, irrelevant, who should win, more relevant, and then we'll give you an egregious omission. Part of that egregious omission is we do have to replace a current nominee, whether we feel great about it or not. The nominees for Best Supporting Actor are Kieran Hines for Belfast. It's his first nomination. Troy Kotsur for Coda, his first nomination. He did win the BAFTA, the Independent Spirit Award, and the SAG Award. Another first-time nominee, Jesse Plemons for The Power of the Dog. J.K. Simmons, of course, won very memorably for Damien Chazelle's Whiplash. He's back, second-time nominee for Best Supporting Actor for Being the Ricardos. And finally, another first-timer, Cody Smit-McPhee for The Power of the Dog. He did win the award handed out by our critics group, the Chicago Film Critics Association. I know we both had him pretty high up on our list, so tell us your pick, starting with who will win, Josh?
Well, let me ask you a Coda question, because you have seen Coda. That's one I did not get to before recording. Troy Kotsur, does he play the dad? Is that
he plays the dad?
Okay, I'm going to say he's going to win then, just because based purely on the times I've seen that performance mentioned on social media, people seem to be particularly appreciative of that. So that's my pick for who will win, who should win. Yeah, I'm with our CFCA fellow colleagues, Cody Smith McPhee and the Power of the Dog. He is the sneaky key to. That movie, I think we can say, without spoiling anything, should have been nominated. We've talked about Jeffrey Wright many times, Adam, in The French Dispatch, how much we both love that performance. Great performances across the board in that film, but he was at the top for me. I guess it's fitting. He has that great speech about a solitary feast in the film, so fitting he's not invited to the Oscar table here. So who do I take out? That's the question, right? If I'm putting in Jeffrey Wright, I'm gonna take out Kieran Hines. Belfast is the film, the most recent film I saw among the nominees, and it's not at all that I don't appreciate the performance in that film. Every time his character as the grandfather showed up, I perked up a little bit. But it also struck me as the sort of thing Kieran Hines could probably do in his sleep. So I think I'm gonna have to take that one out.
Okay, well, our first category, and we have alignment across the board.
I
think Troy Kotsur will win as well for Coda. The first deaf man nominated for an Oscar. A great story there. Obviously, he's been doing some winning so far on his route to the Academy Awards. I have seen it, as you mentioned, and he's a key part of the movie's most powerful scenes. There's a couple of them, and I think that it's a film voters clearly appreciate. It did get several nominations, including Best Picture. I don't see a lot of voters actually giving it the top prize, so maybe this is a runner-up award, if you will. I think Kotsur will win. Who should win? I'm with you, Cody Smith McPhee. He is an enigma. He starts out as a character who we perceive, at least I did, as very vulnerable, and let's just say develops some more agency as the movie goes on. But it is a sneaky agency, to use your word. And when you leave that movie and you're still pondering some of the events of the film, but also some of the emotional dynamics of the film, I think you really are mostly reflecting on Smith McPhee in his performance. So he is my pick. Plemons would be the pick, because who doesn't love Jesse Plemons? And he certainly deserves the recognition. In this particular case, as we've talked about here on the show, he does disappear halfway through the movie, and that diminishes the performance, or at least the role, a little bit for me. I am going to say this, because you're going to hear it a couple times throughout our choices. The last film I saw in preparation for this show was Being the Ricardos. And I thought for sure the film that I might be here defending, even if half-heartedly defending, of all the movies that got a bunch of nominations, it would be Don't Look Up, right? Great cast. Adam McKay. I did not go for Vice at all, but, you know, I loved The Big Short, my number one film of that year. I thought I would be saying, what's all the fuss about? Pretty watchable, pretty entertaining. And I do think Don't Look Up isn't as bad as most people portrayed it online. But actually, the film I can kind of defend. I'm just a sucker for Sorkin, man. And I think that Being the Ricardos is pretty watchable. And a significant reason why is J.K. Simmons. Not a surprise that he'd give a very good performance. He's pretty consistently good on screen. He plays William Frawley, who was the actor who portrayed Fred on I Love Lucy, and it's one of those performances where you talk about vulnerability. He plays someone who's very gruff, has this very tough demeanor, and always seems to be taking out some kind of aggravation on his co-stars or anyone around him, but there is this emotional core to him, and he ends up being, in some ways, kind of the oracle, or someone that the major characters in that film, Javier Bardem's Desi Arnaz and Nicole Kidman's Lucille Ball, go to, at least Ball, go to when they need a little reassuring.
Honey, I read 7 newspapers every day.
7? When do you have time to do that?
It's 30 minutes between races at Santa Anita, and it takes me a minute and a half to pick a horse.
Aren't you at work?
Yeah, we have bookies now and telephones.
know all about that. Did a Damon Runyon picture?
In none of those seven newspapers have I read anything about Lucille Ball being a communist. I don't hear anyone talking about it.
Since when do you talk to anyone?
I got news for you. The less you talk, the more things you hear. And I haven't heard anything, so...
In some ways, it becomes kind of a sentimental performance and a sentimental character, but Simmons doesn't give any of that away at all. So I just wanted to say, I do think Simmons is really good in being the Ricardos. I'm still going with Schmidt McPhee for The Power of the Dog. I would replace Kieran Hines as well from Belfast. Great actor, always good. But I just think that film and that character ultimately are too slight. If I had my way, I'd give it to Jeffrey Wright for The French Dispatch or to Mike Feist for Spielberg's West Side Story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was fantastic. I only chuckled there while you're talking about being the Ricardos because the phrase pretty watchable.
Yeah.
I like the idea that like all of Hollywood comes together one night to celebrate the pretty watchable. It's
the pretty watchable.
A great Oscar tradition, isn't it?
That's what I can give being the Ricardos. And like Don't Look Up, compared to the vitriol I was seeing for it on social media and on Letterboxd, I think that is almost high praise, Josh. Let's go ahead then to supporting actress. Our nominees are Jessie Buckley for The Lost Daughter, her first nomination, Ariana DeBose, her first nomination. She plays Anita in West Side Story. She did win the BAFTA and the SAG Award this year. Kirsten Dunst, another first-timer, The Power of the Dog. Judi Dench, not so much a first-timer, for Belfast, her eighth nomination. She's been nominated five times before for lead actress. This is her third for supporting. She was last nominated in 2013 for Philomena. She did win supporting actress in 99 for Shakespeare in Love. Finally, Anjanou Ellis for King Richard, her first nomination. What say you, Josh?
I'm going to predict Ariana DeBose has those wins coming into the Oscars that you mentioned. That always helps. And I think it might come down to the Rita Moreno symmetry here that will appeal to voters. You know, Moreno won for this part in 1961. She appears in Spielberg's West Side Story in a different role. So it's kind of a, you know, she's given her a stamp of approval on this version. I think you will likely see, you know, a lot of drama around, you know, this win if it happens. So I think all of that kind of bodes well for Ariana DeBose to get the win here. And I think that's the way it should go. I'd like to see it go that way among these nominees. I was thinking about this and wondering if there's something of a Heath Ledger Joker comparison here, because you have DeBose taking on a legendary part, a legendary performance, one that most people would say an unwise choice to make for a younger performer ahead of The Dark Knight. I think people thought, why would Ledger even try to mess with Jack Nicholson's Joker? But he pulled it off. He matched it at the very least. And I think DeBose does the same thing, honestly, with her performance as Anita in West Side Story. So I do think she should win. As far as who should have been nominated, we've mentioned this a couple of times, the surprise that Ruth Negga did not get a nod for Passing. I think that's where they should have gone here. Not only is she deserving, is the performance deserving, a linchpin performance, another one for that film, really. But honestly, also right there on a platter for an Academy that is needing to diversify its honorees. So it's mystifying to me how Ruth Negga was not noticed for her performance in Passing. And I'm going to go the same way I went with the other category in terms of who to take out. Mm-hmm. I think Judi Dench will be just fine. She would be just fine if she didn't get this nomination. And I mean, not only could she do this performance in her sleep, I think she could do this in a coma. So Judi Dench, I'm afraid, would have to go.
To her credit, she doesn't do that.
No, she's good.
She gives a fine performance.
When Hines shows up, I would put her in the same category. Happy to see her.
Okay. Turns out we really needed Michael because there's more agreement with supporting actress. I think Ariana DeBose will win for really the reasons you mentioned. And also because she deserves to win. She should win the honor. She is just such a force. I know we've talked about her going back to when we reviewed the movie on the show. And I read an interview with her and Ann Thompson over at IndieWire. She said The circumstances this woman is put in are trying. You are able to show a woman with agency in the context of this time period. Our film takes place in 1957. It's not a time when women are encouraged to speak our minds. We may have been running a business, but we were not getting the credit for it. Anita was fire, passion, love. You get to watch a woman who owns their body in a positive light. You also watch a woman go through great grief. You certainly see all those dimensions to her character. And I don't want to compare her against Rita Moreno and diminish that performance in any way. I think you can watch both films, though, and see how Tony Kushner, the screenwriter, did elevate the character or give the character more dimension and more to do, frankly, than Rita Moreno had in the original. And a big part of that as well is the chemistry she has with her Bernardo, David Alvarez. That heat, that dynamic is palpable, which also, of course, heightens the grief element that she mentioned. And I think that key scene for me with DuBose is that one on the stairs near the end of the film where she just kind of has to compose herself after what she just withstood talking to a cop who clearly has no regard for what she is experiencing in that moment. Dench, I'd replace, and I'd replace her with Ruth Negga as well. I would be happy if anybody else in this category won. Of course, DuBose, but also Buckley, Dunst, and Anjanue Ellis, having just caught up with King Richard. I think Michael said here on the show the last time he was on, or at least a recent time we spoke to him. Maybe I'm confusing show conversations with Michael with just seeing him at a screening, but he said something about King Richard and that Ellis performance and that she really has one or two big scenes that are crucial to that film and that they finally take the spotlight off that title character. It's about King Richard more than anyone else. It's certainly about him more than it's about Venus or Serena Williams, his daughters. It's about how he brought them along, his tutelage, his influence. But the writer, Zach Baylin, and the director, Ronaldo Marcus Green, are wise enough to balance him out a little bit with a character who is a force herself and who might actually be even more charismatic than Richard, played by Will Smith. And she provides the stability that her daughters need and that the movie needs.
Are we a team?
Are we a team? We're family.
So we're a team.
We're a family, the best kind of team.
You don't think that that was a decision that you should have discussed with me? Discussed with Venus? Richard, my faith dictates that I stand by your side.
All right, well, just do that.
Don't mistake my silence for agreement. You do that again, and I won't be quiet.
Now, don't do that. Don't do that to me.
You don't make a fool out of me.
Who made a fool out of you? What
you. You made a fool out of me.
What are you talking about?
Don't make a fool out of me.
Ain't nobody made no fool out of you.
She's very good, so would be content, Josh. If anybody won, and it's not as if I'm against Judi Dench, it does just feel like one of those performances she could knock out anytime, as you mentioned, and we want to spread the love around a little bit. Let's bring some first-timers in.
Yeah, nothing. We have nothing against Judi Dench on this show. Let's be clear about
that. We're Judi Dench on Film Spotting. Let's make that emphatically clear. Okay, that brings us to the lead performances, and we will start with lead actor Javier Bardem being the Ricardos. He's been nominated 4 times, last in 2010 for Beautiful. He was the supporting actor winner in 2008 for Anton Chigurh, No Country for Old Men. Benedict Cumberbatch, the star of The Power of the Dog. It's his second nomination, previously nominated for The Imitation Game in 15. Andrew Garfield, Tick, Tick, Boom. Had forgotten this. Also, I don't think I saw the movie. Hacksaw Ridge in 2017 earned him a nomination. Will Smith as King Richard, his third acting nom. He was last nominated in 2007 for The Pursuit of Happiness. He won the SAG. He won the BAFTA. And how about Denzel Washington, The Tragedy of Macbeth, one-upping Dame Judi Dench, his 9th acting nomination, 2-time winner, supporting actor in 90 for Glory, actor in 02, King Kong, ain't got nothing on him, Training Day. Who do you think this one's going to go to?
Well, I'm really leaning on these early season award winners here for my predictions. So I'm looking at these BAFTA wins and the SAG wins, probably because I've been out of the loop more than most years in terms of awards buzz. I mean, I don't usually dig too much into it, but I feel like in previous years, I've at least paid a little bit more attention. So just looking at these facts and looking at that it's Smith's third acting nomination, without a win before, I think it's going to be Will Smith's time for King Richard. Should win, no surprise to anyone who listens to this show. Benedict Cumberbatch, The Power of the Dog. I will forgive him every outsized performance he gives for the rest of his career because we got this one, which I think is just an all-timer from him. Should have been nominated. I'm kind of torn between two here. So if we are the same down the line, Adam, maybe we can switch and I'll pick a different one. But I'm thinking of Dev Patel in The Green Knight. Would have loved to have seen him get a nod for what I think is a tricky performance. It has a lot of comedy. He's kind of poking fun of his character in the performance. Yet there are also those moments where he's absolutely the heroic figure that the movie needs at times. So I love the dexterity of that performance. But how about Simon Rex in Red Rocket? Mm-hmm. I mean, what a revelation. What a pure performance. It's not only just the novelty of it. I think he really brings it. So if I had to choose, I'd probably go with Rex. I like to think that Patel's time will come down the road at some point for the Oscars. I don't know what the future holds for Simon Rex. So this time, if I had to choose, I would go with a nomination for him. And I'm going to take out you. I mean, you know who I'm going to take out, but it's not because I had a problem with the performance. I think
you haven't seen it.
I think Andrew, what?
You're not going to go Ricardo's?
No, I can't. Yeah, I can't choose the category I haven't seen. So, or the Andrew Garfield, you know, I did admire the commitment he brought to Tick, Tick, Boom. I think that's what it had to have. And yet, you know, as we've covered, not really my type of movie. So I would take him out. He's certainly not better than Denzel Washington, The Tragedy of Macbeth. And yeah, I haven't seen Bardem or Smith, so I can't take one of them out.
Well, we're going to diverge only a little bit. I also have Will Smith winning it. Feels like his time, feels like he is due. Who should win? It should be The Batch. Benedict Cumberbatch. We talked so much about the menace he brings to that character, how assaultive he is, despite the fact that he doesn't ever actually really do anything physically, at least to any other characters. It's just how he does it with his looks and his general demeanor. And there's a sophistication to him that makes him someone as loathsome as he is. You understand why when some very important people are over at the ranch, they're really excited about having dinner with him. They're ready to have their evening elevated by this man. He proves to be a little bit more difficult than they bargained for. I think it is a magnetic performance.
Oh, you're Phil. So you weren't eaten by a cougar?
Not yet.
Well, I am sorry to have missed your conversation. I've heard that you're brilliant.
You're going to want to keep your distance and just off the horse. Anyhow, so you don't want conversation. You've been listening to the piano and dancing, I guess. You dance?
In terms of the biggest omission, you know I'm with you on Simon Rex. Pretty sure I had him as my favorite actor of the year for Red Rocket in our Chicago Film Critics Association ballots, but I backed off him here just a little bit and went with someone else on my ballot only because, you know, it's not like we really thought the Academy was going to recognize Simon Rex. It seemed like too much of a long shot. And the one I'll throw in instead is Nicolas Cage for Pig.
Yeah.
In a performance that feels like it belongs in the discussion among his career best. Obviously, a return to form in terms of quality, considering all the films he's made over the past 10 plus years and some of those wild performances. Watching Nicolas Cage be incredibly engaging on screen again, especially when he's that subtle, was so refreshing. And I'm legitimately surprised and legitimately disappointed Nicolas Cage didn't squeeze in there among the top five for the Academy. If I was taking someone out, I like all of these performances. but I think I would probably remove Bardem for being the Ricardos. He's incredibly charismatic. He has great chemistry with Nicole Kidman, which he has to have for that relationship to work, for it to make sense on screen, for that Sorkin dialogue to crackle the way it has to. He gets some great performance scenes as well. I assume he's doing the performing there and not lip syncing as Desi Arnaz, but it also feels maybe, no pun intended, a little bit too one note. He gets to rely mostly on that charisma. So if I had to replace someone, I'd throw Cage in and I'd take out Javier Bardem.
Yeah, I really thought Cage had a good shot of being among the top five for the Oscars here. It is a surprise. And I thought about that, too, when we were making our replacements. You know, we could both probably pick a lot of wild, either like foreign language films mm-hmm. or deep indie films that we think should have gotten the recognition. But in some cases, I did consider how much of a long shot that would actually be.
That brings us to Best Actress. The nominees are Jessica Chastain for The Eyes of Tammy Faye. It's her third nomination. Last nominated in 2013 for Zero Dark Thirty, she did win the SAG Award. Olivia Colman, The Lost Daughter, also her third. She was last nominated in 2021 for The Father, and she won in 2019 for Yorgos Lanthimos, The Favorite. Penelope Cruz, her fourth acting nomination. Her last one was in 2010 for Nine, and she did win. I forgot that. She won in 09 for Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Nicole Kidman, we just keep one-upping the prior names here. Nicole Kidman for being the Ricardos. It's her fifth nomination. She was last nominated in 2017 for Lion, opposite Dev Patel. And she won way back in 2003 for The Hours. Kristen Stewart, now one of our most acclaimed, revered actresses, getting her first nomination as Princess Diana in Spencer. How does this one come out for you, Josh?
I think Sam was right in choosing a Jessica Chastain clip to lead off this show because I do think she's going to win. Bigger is still often better, not always, but often when it comes to the Academy. And she went big here, though I think it was the right choice. I don't always, as I said with Benedict Cumberbatch, I don't always go for those types of performances, but that is absolutely fitting for the persona she's trying to capture in The Eyes of Tammy Faye. So I think she's got a good shot of winning this. Should win. My favorite performance from a woman actor last year was Olivia Colman in The Lost Daughter. And it's really sort of the opposite of Chastain when you think about it. It's almost entirely interior and just remarkable. So she would be my pick for who should win from this group. On my ballot, though, a little bit below Olivia Colman was Taylor Page from Zola. I think she should have gotten a nomination. She is our snarky, cynical guide to that wild ride that is Zola. And so I think she should have been in this group. And as far as who I would take out, I can't take out Kidman, not having seen Being the Ricardos. I'm eager to hear what you made of her in that film, mm-hmm. Adam, because I heard a lot of different things, not all of them, as you said, very kind. So we'll see what you made of that. But if I can't take out Kidman, then, and I don't feel good about this because it's another one where I like the performance, but I think Kristen Stewart would be the one I would remove. Yeah. I just think, you know, we did a show, I believe it was Top 5 Kristen Stewart Scenes, and a number of years ago, and there are, you know, a handful of better performances from her that we covered on this list. I also think that, you know, she's going to definitely deliver something even more worthy down the road in her career. So if I had to take someone out, it would probably be Kristen Stewart.
Well, alignment again to start here. Who will win? I think it's going to be Chastain. And I'm aligned with you as well that I like the performance. And I think it's probably the best aspect of that film. Three people nominated in this category for playing a real person. We know how much the Academy mm-hmm. loves that. Of course, Chastain is one of those three. And of those three, it's by far the biggest and the one that feels the most transformative. So that seems like pretty easy pickings for the
Academy. that's true. In terms of you wouldn't even know it's Chastain, right?
Right.
So yeah, they love that too.
They do. Who should win? I agree. Olivia Colman for The Lost Daughter. Going the opposite end of the spectrum from Chastain, you said how interior it was. It is a quiet performance, but there is nothing small about it or lacking in vigor. And that really is Coleman's magic.
Look, I'm sorry about earlier as well. I was feeling a bit anxious.
Yeah. Well, you know, the sun can do that. And, well, maybe your girls, being away from your girls, you know?
Yeah, well, you'll see. Children are a crushing responsibility.
Having just caught up with Parallel Mothers, though, a few days ago, can definitely say that Cruz is a wonder in that film and really grounds the melodramatic aspects of it that you fully expect and desire from Pedro Almodovar. I think that that collaboration just continues, obviously, to be so fruitful. In terms of replacement and omission, almost went with someone else here, Josh, because of our previous conversation around realistic expectations. But then this film did get two Oscar nominations, that film being The Worst Person in the World. And for me, the performance of the year was Renata Reintz, the lead in that Joachim Trier film. So very disappointed that she didn't get a nomination, whether I felt it was highly likely or not, she would be my top pick. And I'm with you. I really considered taking out Stewart for Spencer, because I'm just going to be honest, it's a performance that I respect, but I'm still reckoning with what she is doing exactly as Princess Diana and how effective it is. I think it's certainly provocative, and I give it credit for that. It's something I'd like to consider more on a second viewing.
Yeah, it kind of, for me, it splits down between two things. It's what she's doing vocally and what she's doing physically.
Yes.
And, you know, the vocal rhythms that she goes back to over and over just were a stumbling block for me. But the way she carried herself and the pressures that Diana felt and the way she wore the dresses, which are so integral to that role, I think it was just marvelous. So it was. I know what you're saying. It's like a hard performance to kind of come to a firm feeling about, because there were some elements that worked so well for me and others that didn't.
William told me before we came here he didn't want to shoot guns.
I want to talk because someone said something about clothes.
Will he be all right?
Yes, of course he'll be all right. Your dresser said something about clothes.
I mean, will he be safe?
It's perfectly safe. You wear protective glasses.
How can it be safe if you have to wear protective glasses?
Yesterday, you arrived after the Queen.
I got lost.
Oh, how could you get lost? You've lived over the hill for years.
It looks different now. Everything looks different.
So, yeah, tough choice between Kristen Stewart for Spencer and Chastain for The Eyes of Tammy Faye. I think ultimately I will go with replacing Stewart, which does break my heart as well, because I'm glad to see her finally get this recognition as truly one of our best actresses. This is tough when you're replacing people who you not only really respect, but you like the performance. As I said, it's one that, you know, you can see it in your head. You don't remember individual lines. You maybe don't even remember specific scenes. I remember the feeling I had watching her moment to moment navigate the terror of that weekend. And that has to count for something. So I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth here if we have to replace someone. But I did really like Nicole Kidman, and she's not who I'm kicking out at all.
Okay.
I know that there's been some talk about the Lucille Ball impression. That always comes up when actors portray real people. And I thought she navigated that as well as an actor could, in that obviously they did try to match her physical appearance to some extent. She went to great lengths to capture Ball's unique physical style of comedy, but there was nothing about it that felt like she was trying to mimic Lucille Ball. Instead, she was trying to capture something a little bit more evasive, which was a sensibility, a mood. It's a Sorkin movie, so a genius, you know, that she has. This is a Sorkin film. She's the tortured genius of this movie. She can talk circles around everybody she's in a dialogue with. There are scenes, or at least one in particular, that feels like something right out of Molly's Game and other Sorkin films, where she's defending her personal integrity. You've got these recurring narrative threads. you have a certain discord or conflict that's introduced, and you think the movie is maybe going to turn away from that, or that's going to be resolved, and then Sorkin does that little trick, that screenwriting trick, where you realize, no, that's kind of what the film's been about the entire time. And it's also, of course, being Sorkin, a movie that is very much about drama. It's about writing. It's about the way artists connect with audiences through words and bringing those to life coming off a page. And it works to the extent it does, in large part, not solely, as I said, like Simmons, like Bardem, like a lot of the writing. But Kidman is the biggest reason why I think it works. Without her being able to bring that not only physical style of comedy, but that dexterity with the dialogue, this movie falls completely flat.
Lucy guesses some names.
Yeah, teasingly.
And the script indicates that Ricky takes his hands away from Lucy's eyes, turns her around and says...
No, it's me.
So my question again, Jess. Does Ricky honestly, truly believe that there might be 8 different men who routinely walk into their apartment, all of whom sound exactly like Desi Arnaz?
You think we're saying Ricky's stupid?
I think you're saying the audience is. And that's something for which they won't soon forgive you.
All right, the Best Director and Best Picture categories are still to come. Do we foresee a Power of the Dog sweep? That's next, plus a little Golden Brick spotting and the Sweet 16 matchups in Film Spotting Madness. Stay with us.
So, you live here too?
Yeah.
The whole school's cursed.
Okay, you're gonna have to try a lot harder than that to scare me.
Seriously, it's real.
You're listening to Film Spotting. That's from the trailer for Master, not The Master. It's new in theaters this weekend. It is also on Amazon Prime. A college-set horror film. It's the feature directing debut of Mariama Diallo. In the movie, 3 black women try to find their place at an elite New England university, a university that happens to be built on the grounds of a Salem-era Gallows Hill. Cue the jump scares and the social commentary. Josh, you caught up with Master, and you're nominating it, not for an Academy Award. You, alas, don't have that power, but you are putting it up as, I believe, our first Golden Brick nominee of the year.
Yeah, I think so, which is about average. I think it takes a couple months for us to get a chance to see some of these smaller films from up-and-coming filmmakers, and they tend to, I think, fall maybe in a couple of categories. We've been so lucky, Adam, over the years where we'll come across just some knockout debuts, you know, that are, you would never guess our debuts. And those get nods for the Golden Brick. But we also have a handful that are very promising. That's kind of the idea behind it, right? A young filmmaker that shows a lot of promise. And maybe the film has a few things that don't entirely work for you. I would put Master in this category. Glad I saw it. Well worth seeing, especially if you are a fan of horror and social commentary horror. There is some structure. It takes on a ton. I mean, despite, I should say, in addition to those things you just mentioned, it also involves an actual witch. There's psychological horror here. It's kind of a haunted house movie. And jumping back and forth among all those things gets a little messy. But what I did love was the idea that writer-director Mariama Diallo has. This is her feature debut, because when you think about like storied American history or these places that have just such prestige going back to the country's founding, how often are you so aware that they're really hiding from the ghosts of racism that are also embedded in those places? And maybe this is fresh in my mind because Debbie and I just got back a few weeks ago from a long delayed anniversary trip to Savannah, Georgia. And beautiful city, amazing parks. The weather was gorgeous, but within 24 hours there, we're walking around thinking something's a little eerie here. Something seems missing. And sure enough, you start doing a little more investigating, looking a little further than where, you know, Savannah Tourism Department wants you to look. And yes, this was the heart of the slavery trade. And there is evidence of that all over the place. But the city doesn't really want to recognize it. And that's what this movie is about. But it's looking at that dynamic specifically at this prestigious university. That's a great idea. And there are two visual ways. There's one really intriguing visual way that Diallo explores this, which are with these portraits of previous masters. Regina Hall is the main character, the master of this residence hall. And in that building and in other buildings across campus are these legacy portraits of course, white people who were there at the founding of the university. Those portraits are always a little creepy. And in this movie, Diallo really emphasizes that. There's actually a moment where the other main character, a freshman, one of the few African-American students played by Zoe Renee, looks at one of those portraits and does a double take because the face seems to be kind of like deformed and distorted to her. And so those are just nice ways of hinting at this underlying threat of racism, the horror of racism that is still there. And so I liked that. I like touches like Regina Hall's character moving into her new place and finding an Aunt Jemima-like figurine stuffed in the back of a cabinet, some photos she finds. So there are really nice moments where Diallo makes this unsettling in an insidious way. And then, like I said, storytelling-wise, it gets a little bit clunkier, a little more on the nose that doesn't work quite as well. But still do want to give it our first nod as a Golden Brick film for 2022.
Consider me intrigued. Again, Master opens in limited release this weekend. It's also on Amazon Prime. Speaking of intriguing, and this is happening in real time as we're recording this episode, Josh, I happen to glance over at Twitter and Ross Bratton, longtime listener, regular trivia spotting participant, quote tweeted Eric Cohn from IndieWire, who just about a half an hour ago as we are talking, tweeted this: loved at Michael Rianda's New York Film Critics Circle's acceptance speech. Michael Rianda, the director of Mitchell's versus the Machines, which I just recommended to my best friend, one of my best friends from college this past weekend. And of course, the creative director of Gravity Falls, which all of my kids adore. Cohen says he loved his speech as he geeked out over being in the same room as David Sims, Alison Wilmore, Matt Singer, quote, RIP film spotting SVU, unquote. And cited a David Ehrlich take on AI. This is what makes this dinner an essential awards season stop. Allison confirmed that on Twitter. She said, I died. So how about that, Mike Rianda, with love for the departed film spotting SVU?
Can you, this is an inside joke for trivia spotting people, but I'm hoping to see this tweet framed and added to your personal wall of fame there you shared with us.
Yeah, I'll be claiming that Mike and I are just long lost.
There you go.
Best friends.
That's what I'm hoping for.
That tweet on next week's show. Josh, we're going to do something we call a top five. Do you remember those?
Yes. I don't know if I've done one myself in a long time. We've shared a couple, I think, recently, but yeah, I recall them.
Okay. Well, we're going to see if we can remember how to ride a bike. We're going to do a top five. And that top five is not Hitchcock films, but it's Hitchcockian films. The top five inspired by another film that's coming to streaming this weekend, Windfall. It's on Netflix, and it's the new one from director Charlie McDowell. He made 2014's The One I Love with Elizabeth Moss and Mark Duplass, a movie we talked about here on the show, a movie I liked a lot back in 14. And then in 2017, he made The Discovery with Jason Segel and Rooney Mara. We were both a little bit mixed on The Discovery, but a fascinating concept and proved that McDowell is one of those filmmakers who you really want to keep an eye on and see what he's going to do next. And what he's doing next is Windfall, which again stars Segel along with Jesse Plemons and Lily Collins. It's about a man who breaks into a tech billionaire's empty vacation home only to be surprised by the man and his wife. From there, we've been assured anyway that things get Hitchcockian.
Now, here's going to be a test of whether we really take on a top five Hitchcockian films is if we both put The Power of the Dog on there because we don't have to do any more work. It's right there. It's sitting there for us, Adam, right there.
It is.
Possibly off of an Oscar win or about to get an Oscar win. But that's what we're talking about, right? Films that distinctly recall the technique, the concerns, the themes of Hitchcock's Best.
Yeah, that's it. And I think we'll see what we bring to the table next week in terms of looking at that list of conventions or tropes, whatever it is we identify most with Hitchcock, and see what resonates with us, or at least what resonates with the movies we want to call out on next week's show. I already had a bunch of homework to do for this week's show in terms of catching up with some Oscar choices. I have at least three, maybe four movies I really feel like I have to watch before I can have any credibility talking about Hitchcockian films. I won't mention them now. Hopefully they'll come up on next week's show, if not in my top five, as honorable mentions. Also next week, we'll have more Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 70s, the Sweet 16 results, and the Elite 8 matchups.
We always like to keep folks updated on what's going on over at the Next Picture Show. Here's one just tailor-made for me. That's how I like to think about it. They are pairing After Yang, the Koganada film we both raved about last week, Adam, in the lead for Best Film of the Year for me at this early stage, pairing that with Steven Spielberg's AI, Artificial Intelligence. I'm with Keith. I've already heard the first installment of this pairing where they talk about AI, and I'm with Keith Phipps that film is top tier Spielberg. Now, in addition to Keith, your Next Picture Show hosts are Tasha Robinson, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts, and you can find more information at nextpictureshow.net.
You're an amazing woman. What a feeling having you inside my head.
Yeah, it was an unusual place to be.
It's like indescribable. You knew just when to feed me the next line. You knew the second before I needed it. There was like a rhythm we got into. It was like great sex.
An actor who appeared in AI, of course, was William Hurt. We got the news over the weekend that he passed away at the age of 71. One of the most acclaimed actors of the 80s, and we will enumerate some of those performances and films. We do want to acknowledge that the reason why we don't right now have anything planned in terms of a top five paying tribute to William Hurt is the complication of the fact that accompanying the heaps of praise for him and his acting talent on social media were reports that he allegedly emotionally and physically abused women in his life, most notably his Children of a Lesser God co-star Marlee Matlin. In terms of what he did on screen, Best Actor nominations, Josh, in three straight years. 86, Kiss of the Spider Woman. 87, Children of Lesser God. And then in 88 for Broadcast News, he did win for Spider Woman. Later nominated in 06. Only 8 minutes of screen time, but boy, does William Hurt really make good use of those 8 minutes in David Cronenberg's A History of Violence. He debuted in 1980 in Altered States and had other notable 80s appearances in Body Heat and, of course, The Big Chill. Loved him in Smoke in the 90s, written by Paul Auster, directed by Wayne Wang. And then, along with A History of Violence and AI in the 2000s, he was in a movie I think you quite like to defend, Josh, M. Night Shyamalan's The Village.
Yeah, I'm a fan of The Village. I was still on the Shyamalan bandwagon. I think that's how you say it. Shyamalan bandwagon.
The Shyamalan wagon.
There you go.
And in 2008, he was, like the rest of us, absorbed into the MCU as Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross in The Incredible Hulk. He reprised the role in Captain America Civil War, Avengers Infinity War, and Endgame, along with Black Widow. One of those actors who I did always consider to be quite a subtle performer, actually. And then it's that History of Violence performance where you realized, oh, he's a guy who can go quite big if he wants to.
How do you f*** that up? How do you f*** that up?
Yeah, and as far as that on-screen work goes and looking at recognize it in some way, if we do decide to tackle it, I almost ask if we do like a blind cow, because I am sorely missing out on that prime Hurt stuff you mentioned. I have not seen Body Heat. I've not seen The Big Chill. Have not seen Kiss of the Spider Woman, Children of a Lesser God, or This is the one that's really going to hurt you, what? I imagine, Adam. Have not seen broadcast news. So there's no way, like, for me to even do a top five, if that was in the play, I mean, I need, like, a couple months here to get through all these. But I would like to do a blind cow of one of those, maybe. Maybe broadcast news should be it.
Broadcast news should be it. Sam said it in the Film Spotting newsletter this week. It's hard for him. It's hard for me to separate Hurt from that performance, that character as Tom Grunick. Love that James L. Brooks film, and do think that performance is special, along with many in that film, including, of course, Holly Hunter, Albert Brooks as well. So that's one we might just have to pencil in on the calendar, Josh, a blind cow review of broadcast news.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
This madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
We are cruising through madness this year, Josh, just as actual March Madness is set to begin. We are already down to our Sweet 16. First things first, want to mention, the Sweet 16, Best of the 70s, is live as you're listening to this. Unless, you know, you're listening way down the line. To vote, just go to filmspotting.net. Voting closes every Monday at 11 a.m. Central Time. The new rounds go live on Tuesdays, and we do give our family members over on Patreon a first shot at those polls on Mondays. We like to highlight some of the results, starting with the biggest blowouts and going to the tightest matchups, including a couple of upsets we did have in round two. So, Josh, the first couple blowouts here, the number one seed, The Godfather, took down Hal Ashby's Harold and Maude 88% to 12%. The number two seed, Star Wars, easy time with Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets, 82% to 18%.
Would have thought that might have been a little bit closer, just a little bit. Wow, okay. The number three seed, Jaws, took out Cassavetes, A Woman Under the Influence. That was an 88-12 percentage win there. And we got a comment here from my one-time trivia spotting teammate, Ofer Liebergall. They should have sent Jenna Rollins to fight against the shark. Nothing is more powerful than her performance. But here, the father of the blockbuster will probably crush the father of the indie, despite my vote for Cassavetes. Oh, man, Ofer, I don't know if we could be on a team together again after that. I would rather live in a world without a killer shark than a world without Rollins.
Well, you can't really argue with that, can you, Josh?
I mean, I'm never going to vote against Jaws.
Okay. The number four seed, The Godfather Part Two, took down David Lynch's Eraserhead, 81 to 19%. Amanda says, David Lynch and his disturbing Eraserhead baby, oppressive, sinister soundtrack, beautiful black and white imagery, and grotesque humor set the table for an amazing career. Except no substitute. Amanda, unfortunately, in the minority on that one.
She's not wrong, though. Apocalypse Now won over Malick's Days of Heaven, 81% to 19%. Taxi Driver.
Oh, you love it.
I mean,
feels so good.
I did ask for the keys to the incinerator from Sam. I'm going to take care of this one personally. Rocky. It's going to get burnt. Going to get burnt. 78% to 22%. Here's Duncan in Royal Oak, Michigan. I feel like this is some sort of optimism, pessimism quiz question. If that's the case, color me an optimist, because I'll take Rocky's positive masculinity over Taxi Driver's toxic masculinity any day of the week.
Take that, Duncan. Counterpunching, Josh. He's counterpunching against you. You can't take it.
Oh, I've got my fists up. I keep them up. Uh-huh. I've learned that from Rocky. Always in front of the face.
Alien just devoured Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein, 77 to 23. And finally, among the blowouts, Chinatown, just destroying my childhood, beating Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, 71% to 29%. Jonathan Anderson says, I'd rather be subjected to any of the children's fates in Wonka than have to make the choice I know I have to. Forget it, Jonathan. It's Chinatown. Okay, the ones in round two that kept things kind of interesting. Josh?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, one out over Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, but it was kind of close, 66% to 34%. We heard this from Sam, not Our producer, Sam Van Halgren, another Sam, said, Barry Lyndon is glorious and endlessly watchable. If you find it boring, perhaps you belong in the incinerator. Whoa, oh. That escalated.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a few people out there who think that Barry Lyndon is endless. They'd be wrong. It's long, but it's quite a good film.
It's great.
Still, I voted for Cuckoo's Nest over it, as did 66% of the voters. Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. The Droogs crushed Robert Altman's Nashville 65-35. Altman, he started with three titles in the tournament. Along with Nashville, he had McCabe and Mrs. Miller and The Long Goodbye. They're all gone. Altman, maybe the king of the 70s.
Yeah, really.
Not getting his due here in Film Spotting Madness.
So this is the moment to pause and recognize how ridiculous this entire enterprise is.
Right, right. Peter Ketter says, this one hurts me, Gulliver, but the Omni Pretty Polly is on Clockwork Orange. Kubrick and the Sophistos will deliver a Tolchak to Altman's Yarbles.
I think that's all well used and accurate.
It is. Finally, 63%-37%, Klaus Kinski is not happy, even though if I was going to take any real-life actor in a fight against Michael Myers, it would be Klaus Kinski over Michael Myers. But Halloween and John Carpenter went out over Werner Herzog here.
Put me in a dark house with Michael Myers over Klaus Kinski any day.
Any day. The Nailbiters, Josh, we have Alan Pakula's All the President's Men versus Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, 57%-43%.
Here's Aaron Teachman. This is so hard. It's like asking whether you believe it's possible for the good guys to win, even temporarily, or whether justifiable paranoia and dread will haunt your every waking moment. Have fun making that choice. Welcome to round two, I guess.
Go home, take a shower, then get back to work. If you screw up again, I'm going to get mad. Isn't that what Jason Robards says? Close.
Sounds about right. There might have been a Sophisto or a Tolchak in there.
There might have been.
Yeah.
Our next close matchup, Woody Allen's Annie Hall versus Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And Close Encounters takes it 57%-43%.
Here's John DeCicero in Wichita, Kansas. Can this round of film spotting be the long due requiem for Close Encounters? John, no. Sure, the final act is a gorgeous spectacle, but the movie never reckons with the personal havoc that Roy's obsession wreaks on his family. He might be the worst cinematic father in this tournament, which includes Darth Vader. Annie Hall, on the other hand, dives deep into the flaws of the main character and mines them for great laughs and emotional resonance. I hope Annie Hall wins because we need the eggs.
Well, as someone who voted for Annie Hall, I still get to say back to John that all of those comments about Close Encounters are straight out of Wichita, Kansas. Yes, I'm giving more love to All the President's Men. I think that's the point. That's the beauty, the enigma that is Close Encounters.
Agreed.
Of the Third Kind and Roy Neary. So, John, I will say I appreciate your support of Annie Hall. It is gone. It's in the incinerator. Only 43% of the vote. Sidney Lumet's Network against William Friedkin's The Exorcist. Two personal favorites of mine. A very, very tough choice. Network did take it 52-48, a slight upset. We had Network actually seated slightly lower than The Exorcist, but Lumet won.
Corey Kraft from Birmingham, Alabama weighed in on this one. Toughest vote of round two, but I went with The Exorcist, which remains a thought-provoking roller coaster ride of sheer horror.
There's a fair amount of provocativeness and sheer horror in Network as well, I might say. Monty Python and the Holy Grail went up against Dog Day Afternoon. And Josh, another upset. Yes, the Holy Grail took down Al Pacino, took down John Cazale, 57%-43%.
Another win for the comedies. Here's Jeremy Webner-Berman. I'll be voting for Holy Grail to the finals. Holy cow. All right.
Okay. Well, maybe Jeremy knows something we don't, Josh.
Another comedy here. Blazing Saddles, the 52 seed, took on the 20 seed, The French Connection, and won. This is, it looks like, the biggest upset. The vote was close, 52% to 48%, but the biggest upset in the round.
Yeah, Friedkin, he's out. The French Connection, a Best Picture winner. The Exorcist, one of the best pictures, in my opinion, of the 1970s. They're both gone. Patrick Banks says, I see the bot I employed for Blazing Saddles to advance work beautifully. Kept it close so as not to create suspicion. Hedley Lamarr would be proud. Indeed, he would. Thank you to everyone who participated in round two. We will now get to the Sweet 16 matchups, and we're getting to the rounds where they're tidy enough that we can actually go through the picks here one by one. 16 films, 8 matchups, Josh, in real time. Am I correct that you have not looked at these yet? We're going to get your gut reactions.
That's right. Give it to me.
Okay. So I will preface this by saying that overall, didn't find these matchups to be too tough. In fact, longtime listener Edwin Arnoden over on Twitter said, all great films, but the easiest round yet. I don't know if that's quite true because there are two here that I find completely agonizing, and I actually might, when we get to them, break my microphone or something so I don't actually have to comment because I find them that hard. So a quarter of these are awful, but the other six, no hesitation, knew right away how I was going to vote. Let's see how you do. I'm going to start with those six I found pretty easy, Josh. The Godfather versus Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Love Close Encounters. This is easy. It's The Godfather.
Okay. We're in lockstep so far. The Godfather Part Two going up against Blazing Saddles.
No,
this one's also easy.
Let me employ my own. This is the last. No, it's not the last comedy. Yeah, but I'm not going to vote for. Fine, The Godfather Part Two.
Yeah, it doesn't matter that Coppola's got three in the Sweet 16. Josh, it's just the way it should be.
I feel beholden. I feel like someone's, you know, threatening me with something if I don't vote for The Godfather. So,
well, you do have another comedy alive, as you said, Monty Python and the Holy Grail going up against Travis Bickle and Taxi Driver.
Yeah, but I'm not going to vote against Taxi Driver. So
no,
I am ashamed of myself for voting against both comedies in this round.
Yeah, very unlike you, but that's how good these films are. How about Star Wars against Network?
Star Wars against Network. I'm trying to get that nostalgia filter out and seeing how that works. It's still going to be Star Wars for me.
Yeah, it's still Star Wars.
Yeah.
And I might be the biggest fan of Network on the planet, but in terms of the galaxy, Star Wars wins out. How about Chinatown versus Halloween?
Chinatown. Yeah.
Okay.
Agreed. Easy.
And we have Jaws versus One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I know how you're voting in that one.
Easier. Jaws it is.
I agree. So the two that I found so tough, and one of them I think is probably easy for you. Let's go ahead and start with that one.
Okay.
Another Coppola. Apocalypse Now. All the President's Men.
Yeah, I think I had Apocalypse Now when we did our sight and sound list in 2012, either in the top 10 or I'm pretty sure in the top 20. So this is pretty easy given that.
I just don't even want to talk about this one. I find it just repugnant. We are monsters.
This is your idea.
Sam and I should be banned.
Mike Merrigan's idea, but you endorse it.
Yeah, we should be banned. Apocalypse Now, a film that if it wasn't in my top 10 sight and sound, and it might have been, it was definitely in my 11 through 20. I don't know that All the President's Men back in 2012 made that cut, but if I was redoing the list, it would be in the top 20. I just love that Alan Pakula film that much. And I'm trying to imagine a world where I can't watch that movie again. And I don't want to be in that world. I can't believe it, but I'm picking All the President's Men.
You have to.
I am. How about this one? I actually don't know how you're going to vote in this one. And that works because I don't know how I'm going to vote in this one. Alien.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott up against Stanley Kubrick and A Clockwork Orange.
Ooh, I mean, we both really spent a long, long time praising A Clockwork Orange in a recent revisit within the last year, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So that is fresh in my mind. We also gave Alien a full review at some point in the show's history. Okay, this is what I'm going to do. Star ratings aren't everything, but they are helpful in this situation. So I'm going to my website, going to larsonoffilm.com. Alien 4 out of 4. Clockwork Orange.
Probably three and a half.
It is 3.5. That kind of surprises me, but given that that's the one I visited more recently as well, I'm going to say that I'm going to stick with my, never faulty star ratings and go with Alien. It's Alien.
Well, I can't rely on the star ratings even as I go to Letterboxd because I'm wildly inconsistent when it comes to actually rating films on that website. I gave Alien 4.5 when we reviewed it.
Pretty good.
The problem is, I think I gave A Clockwork Orange over on Rotten Tomatoes 4.5 as well. Certainly at least 4. And I was trying to think about it in these terms earlier today. Thinking about The Incinerator, one of the movies being gone forever. Which film would I most regret not being able to show my enthusiastically budding cinephile daughter, Sophie? I could only pick one. Sophie, you have to see either Alien or A Clockwork Orange. You don't get to see the other. Which one do I make sure she watches? And I am doing the trivia spotting trick here where I am talking slowly and a lot because I'm still stalling.
That's all right. I, like you were during my master review, I'm just over here on Twitter.
Uh-huh. I think my answer is, I think it's Alien.
You're voting for Alien.
I think I'm voting Alien.
Yeah, that's the way to go. That's the right way to go.
They're both incredibly influential and really well-made films. And I just think Alien might be the one in terms of its craft and its impact that it just set the table for not only obviously other Alien films, but so many other films that were balancing those tones, that kind of sci-fi, but the horror. It's Alien. Even though if I think about it any longer, I'm going to just keep changing my mind. So we're going to move on, Josh.
Well, I'm going to hand you the Incinerator keys and you can do the honors with Clockwork Orange. You can burn that one.
I don't want to. You can vote now in all 8 Sweet 16 matchups of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s over at filmspotting.net/madness. That's also where you can check out the bracket and the complete list of titles that made the tournament. I did just discover a little loophole here. My entire reasoning is flawed because Sophie watched A Clockwork Orange with me. She's already seen it.
Yeah, so in that case,
then, no, it works because then I need to save Alien. So
right. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Okay, yeah, these madness rules. They're very bendable, aren't they? You can also, over at filmspotting.net/madness, check out the bracket and the complete list of titles that made the tournament. This is a tournament. That means there's a prediction contest. And our issue with the website hosting the bracket challenge has been resolved at long last. Once we entered the round 2
Thank
results,
goodness.
Josh, technology, it worked itself out. And we believe we have authentic, accurate numbers now. Our winner, or our leader, I should say, after round 1, we'll put an asterisk by that there for a moment. He's now dropped to 9th place. That was Oskari Väinö in Finland. He's moved down a little bit. Turns out he never should have been alone in first place, Josh, as listener Brian Cottrell wrote in to tell us.
This challenge problem is particularly frustrating to me. Why? Because I've got a perfect bracket, but I'm ranked 19th. My bracket is called It Should Be Jaws. Frankly, I expect nothing less than a perfect run through the entire bracket, as I, unlike the, dare I say it, idiot savant who also had a perfect bracket despite only watching 50% of the movies, did my homework. Wow. Brian goes on. I've watched 100% of the movies participating in this year's Film Spotting Madness. I may sound overly confident, but I'm not losing this to some 19-year-old kid who's half as pretentious as I am.
Well, Josh, tell Bryant what place he is in now.
Well, he went from a pseudo first place, it looks like, down to 108th.
Yeah, so he didn't get proper credit last week, and then this week we're making sure the world knows that he's in 108th place. But you had your moment of glory, Bryant, and we wanted to give you your due. And how about, I mean, let's clap it up for 100% of the movies, Josh. That's better than the both of us.
Impressive.
We didn't get to 100%. Close.
Impressive.
Yeah, well done, even if now you are just falling down the bracket challenge leaderboard. Our current leaders, we have another tie for first place. Adam Steyer, who wrote in and said, I'm a longtime listener, probably first began with the podcast around 2008 or so, and I rarely miss a week. He's an English professor at Lake Erie College outside Cleveland. He says, what's cool about being tied for first at this moment in madness is finally having an excuse to write to you all with a long overdue thanks. Film spotting has been a source of pleasure for me for going on a decade and a half now, and Adam and Josh's always engaging conversations have broadened my understanding of cinema in countless ways. I regularly recommend the podcast to my students, knowing the discussions they'll encounter will be simultaneously deep and accessible, insightful, and good-humored. Thank you, Adam, Josh, Sam, and the whole Film Spotting team for all you do to make this happen. Now, before we comment there, we have to acknowledge that he's tied for first with another longtime listener, Brett Fisher, great bracket name, the Jim Beheimlich maneuver. Brett in Portland has not responded to our question as we reached out to him to comment on his tie for first place. So since he is not praising us, we have nothing more to say about Brett.
Wow. I got to say, the tension in this year's tournament seems to be heightened. I know it is generally in society. Maybe that's what it is, but there are threats of throwing people in incinerators.
I know.
I don't know. I don't know if I like it, Adam.
The competition really, really does come out. But seriously, thank you, Adam, for the longtime support of the show, for listening for over a decade, and for participating in Film Spotting Madness. Congratulations on the lead. It might be short-lived. We do have to say that both Brett and Adam only missed one movie over the first two rounds, and it was the same one, like me, they incorrectly picked George Romero's Dawn of the Dead to beat Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. That was their one blemish, at least for now. Sam and I did look ahead at their Sweet 16 picks, and of course, we can look at the back end and see how the voting is going so far, and let's just say that Brett Fisher may be the one who laughs last in these proceedings, because one of them will not be in first place next week, and it might just be our English professor friend, Adam. He got bold. He got bold with a couple of upset picks. Like me, he might have went with his heart in choosing All the President's Men over Apocalypse Now. It's going to be an uphill battle, Josh. That's all I'll say.
Never go with your heart.
Yeah, good advice. Good advice, you shattered middle-aged man. Let's get to the results of our internal bracket prediction contest.
How am I doing?
What really matters here, and it's not who wins, it's who doesn't finish last. In a tie for first place, myself and Sam, one spot behind Bryant Cottrell on the leaderboard, we're in 109th place out of roughly 800. I missed three in round two. I thought French Connection would take down Blazing Saddles. I thought Dog Day Afternoon would surely beat Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And yeah, I thought horror would triumph. I thought The Exorcist would beat Network. Obviously, those didn't happen. Sam also missed three. Like me, thought Exorcist would beat Network. He had Annie Hall over Close Encounters. And yeah, he had Badlands advancing to the Sweet 16. It lost to Blazing Saddles in round one. And then Sam and I, and this kind of makes sense since we, you know, put in all the work and made the bracket, we have identical brackets through the end of the tournament.
Okay. Well,
so we should end up in a tie.
Since we're applauding people, here's for the two of you for being in first.
Thank you. Slow clap. I'll take
it.
Josh, not too bad. You're in 160th place.
Okay.
You missed the exact same three as I did.
Okay. So that was Blazing Saddles, Python, and then Exorcist, right?
Right.
All right.
Right.
But I'm not in last place is what I'm taking away from this.
And I don't know that the godfather of Film Spotting Madness, Mike Merrigan, has much of a chance. He's in 370th place.
Yikes.
He missed four. Saddles, Python, Exorcist. Those got most of us here, it seems. He also had Five Easy Pieces making it to the Sweet 16. It lost in round one to Halloween. So it's going to be a challenge for Mike to not finish in dead last in this tournament and suffer some kind of punishment that we have yet to fully decide. But Mike Merrigan joined us for trivia spotting last weekend.
That's right.
Which was an absolute delight. We remind you that all you need to know about Film Spotting Madness is available at filmspotting.net/madness. And in this round of Film Spotting Madness, piano versus fiddle. We'll find out which one
I'm going
you're
with
taking,
fiddle.
Josh. Yeah, we're going to get back to our Oscar picks with that memorable musical scene from Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog. The Power of the Dog nominated for 12 Oscars, including Best Picture. Campion herself, one of the 5 Best Director nominees. It's her second. She was last nominated in 95 for The Piano. Kenneth Branagh, nominated for Belfast, his second directing nom, last nominated in 89 for My Beloved Henry V. Paul Thomas Anderson for Licorice Pizza, his third. There Will Be Blood in 07, Phantom Thread in 17. A first-timer here in Ryusuke Hamaguchi's Drive My Car. And finally, the man, Steven Spielberg, for West Side Story, 8-time directing nominee, his first since Lincoln in 2013. He won for Schindler's List in 94, Saving Private Ryan in 98, and he was nominated for Close Encounters, Raiders, E.T., Munich, and Lincoln. That's a lot of times up for the big prize. He didn't win it, Josh. Do you think they're going to give it to him here in 2022?
I mean, it's very possible.
It is.
It's kind of a lot of what's going to swing. I think some of the results are how the majority of voters feel about this being a remake. You know, it could work in its favor. I talked about how in DuBose's case, I think it might in the supporting actress category, but maybe not so much the case here with Spielberg, especially someone who's associated with such original visions. I think maybe that will work a little bit against him. So I'm actually not predicting a Spielberg win. I'm thinking the will win and should win are both the same. Jane Campion. And part of the reason I'm a little clouded by this, obviously it's where I would go, but I forgot that she won for the screenplay for The Piano and not for director. And so I think voters who look at that and see that this is a chance to give her first directing honor from the Academy will likely go that route. And in terms of what's on the screen, the control over the various tones in that film, the control of the camera, the use of the camera, It's being employed in very different ways than Spielberg does in West Side Story, but I would say in equally masterful ways. So the work is there. The time has come. The reputation is, if not equal to him, it's still a strong body of work that she has over many years that they can look to. So I think it's going to be Campion. That's what I'd like to see. Who should have been nominated? I mean, I'm still just... And not even from a place of like anger, just confused that the French Dispatch was completely shut out from nominations. Not even so much because of how much I love that movie, but
yeah,
Anderson's track record for the Oscars. It's like once you get in that group, you know, you can sneeze and you're going to get a nomination somewhere. So the fact that that didn't happen with this film is really strange to me. That's who I think should have been nominated is Wes Anderson for Best Director. And I would take out Kenneth Branagh. I know there's a shot he wins this too. I mean, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility at all. For me, you know, people would say Wes Anderson over-directs in a lot of his movies. Belfast is a true example of that. Just a lot of ostentatious choices, mostly for their own sake, not always. Mm. There's an idea at work there involving older movies that the character has seen. I get that. But really a lot of I just don't know if there's like an efficient shot in that film. You know, a shot that's just there to do the work. It's always trying to do something else too. And so that's really why I would swap out Branagh for Wes Anderson.
Yeah, I'm going to have a couple comments along those lines here as we get to Best Picture and the movie we would replace. I think Campion's going to win it. The 12 nominations just suggest to me that it is indeed time. I'm with you. Can't express it any better that Campion should win Best Director for The Power of the Dog of the 5 films nominated here in this category. It's the one I had highest on my top 10 films of the year. And if I'm replacing Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, which is the movie and the choice I would like to remove, I would put in Joachim Trier for The Worst Person in the World. I know I mentioned it earlier with the lead actress Renata Reintzva, my choice for who should have been nominated, that it's hard to call this too egregious an omission if you never really thought it was possible. But with the two nominations that it got and the fact that it was my number two movie of the year and really a contender for my number one spot, that's the movie I wish got a little bit more love here for Best Director, and also, I'll just say it now, for Best Picture.
Well, and Adam, honestly, with Hamaguchi in here for Drive My Car, it wasn't out of the realm of possibility. I mean, that's a surprise to me. It's an outlier of a candidate, a nominee for Best Picture, but really an outlier for Best Director. I was, and that's a fantastic movie, and as expertly controlled and has that, you know, singular artistic vision as any of these others. So it's deserving, but I'll just say it was a surprise to me that Hamaguchi was included.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Obviously, Drive My Car did get a Best Picture nomination as well, but Hamaguchi should be the egregious omission of this category. It's a miracle that he actually is among the finalists. For Best Picture then, Josh, we have these 10 films. Belfast, Coda, Don't Look Up, Drive My Car, Dune, King Richard, Licorice Pizza, Nightmare Alley, The Power of the Dog, and West Side Story. Seems to be, based on just doing a little bit of research and looking at some of the Vegas sites, seems to be down to The Power of the Dog, Belfast, and maybe the feel-good sleeper pick, Coda.
Really?
Competing for the top prize.
Okay. Well, hearing that, you know, Coda just seems, again, haven't seen it, but just seems too small. And if you're going to go the feel-good route, the one that I think voters would go for is Belfast. And I'm sure there's a psychology term for this, Adam, but I'm going to predict Belfast because I hope that in doing so, I will be proven wrong and The Power of the Dog will actually get it. Whatever those sort of mind games you pull on yourself are, that's what I'm trying to pull here. But the question comes down to this: which side of humanity do we want to see right now? Which side of humanity do voters want to see, or did they want to see, what, a couple of weeks ago when they were making their choices? Is it darkness or is it goodness? Power of the Dog gives you the darkness masterfully, but you come out of that movie just, you know, disturbed, I would say. Now, Belfast, I mean, I wouldn't say I was disturbed. I was displeased, but I think most audiences are coming out of it feeling affirmed, feeling good. And you know, that kid is darn cute. You can't take that away from him. Van Morrison has some good songs.
Yes, he does. You know,
and black and white cinematography can be awfully pretty. So I think if voters lean that way, and in dark times, which we are still in the midst of for a lot of reasons, escapism tends to sometimes win the day. It could be Belfast. So I'm going to predict it's Belfast. Power of the Dog is what I want to see, obviously. Lots of good movies in 2021. For me, this was in its own tier at the top. Should have been nominated. This goes back to our conversation about what had a shot and what didn't. Obviously, Identifying Features, my second favorite film from 2021, the winner of the Film Spotting Golden Brick, small film from Mexico. That was never going to happen. But it was my second favorite film after Power of the Dog. So that's what I would say. What had a realistic shot that I wish was there, I'll go back to The French Dispatch. And as far as among the 10, what I would take out, probably the one that I think worked even less well than Belfast, because, you know, there were some choices Belfast made that I think were to good effect. For me, it was Don't Look Up. I have not been on the Adam McKay 2.0 bandwagon since The Big Short. I had issues with that film, had way more issues with Vice, and Don't Look Up just didn't work for me either. So that's the one that I would take out. And I would also just beg Adam McKay to go ahead and make Talladega Nights 2. I think there's no shame in that. No shame at all. That's what I'd like to see.
Well, for me in this category, I'm going to go wishful thinking instead of the reverse psychology you were trying to employ. And I'm going to say The Power of the Dog is going to win. I'm going to log into Twitter at some point next Sunday night, and I'm going to see the good news that film triumphed. I do think it should win. And I've already mentioned the film I wish got nominated in this category instead of just for original screenplay and international feature, The Worst Person in the World. If I had to take one out, I might surprise you here, even though we've been saying negative things about this movie all show, and it's not even that bad of a film by any stretch of the imagination. There are many worse films that have been nominated for Best Picture than Belfast, but I actually do think Belfast is the movie I'd replace instead of Don't Look Up. And I'm not saying I was a fan of Don't Look Up, but I do feel that the kind of precision, the overly manicured, too calculated approach that Branagh employs in Belfast is ultimately not as compelling as the wild swings and misses that Don't Look Up takes. It's at least a movie that I think is going for something really bold, doesn't pull it off, but is really bold and surprises you in some moments with his humor and surprises you in some moments with its pathos, like at the end of the film. Now, do I feel like the movie fully earned that pathos? No, not exactly. But I still think the moment, as it's written, as it's directed, and as it's acted by DiCaprio, still very much works. So for me, that is more interesting than something like Belfast, where it just feels like it's hitting all the notes it needs to hit, maybe on that path to leaving everyone feeling pretty good about themselves as they walk out of the theater. It doesn't really ever surprise. There's that shot that appears everywhere, including on our screener, Josh. I don't know if it's the movie poster or not, but that scene of the family, the four of them sitting in the movie theater in black and white and the projector, mm-hmm. you know, glowing behind them. And that scene itself in the film doesn't convey half of the feeling that the still image does.
Mm.
It just completely falls flat. And again, that calculation, that riot scene at the beginning of the film, you said you're not sure there's really, what was it, an efficient shot in
Belfast? I think
Belfast.
So, yeah.
For me, it's just the camera never feels like it's alive, like it's putting us there in the scene. It feels like Branagh was trying to do the most, to use your term, ostentatious shot he could. And there is just some vitality that is missing in Belfast.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, too, when you mentioned the family being in the movie theater. Boy, that makes me think maybe that's going to be put Belfast over the top because it is a movie about movies. I mentioned briefly how the main character, this boy, goes to the theater regularly. So there will be sequences that are influenced by it's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, right? Isn't that one of the films that
it's been too long since I've seen?
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure. So there's like a sequence that's staged, a showdown between his father and someone in the neighborhood who's trying to shake him down, that's staged like a shootout. And so I understand the concept, but again, it's just a little bit contrived, and other sequences like that in the film don't quite work either. So, but they're movie references, and Academy voters love that. So that's gonna, you know, play in its favor.
Those are our Oscar picks, at least in the big six categories. I thought I would highlight quickly, I don't know if you have a few, Josh, some of the awards and categories that I'll be paying attention to. Even if I'm not watching, I'll be looking forward to seeing how they play out. I'm sorry that if you agreed to take a shot every time I mention this film, you are now hammered, but obviously we'll be rooting for The Worst Person in the World in those two categories, original screenplay and international feature. Rooting for Maggie Gyllenhaal for The Lost Daughter, adapted screenplay. We'll be hoping that Flea emerges victorious in the animated category. It's also nominated for international feature film. And I really do love the Alberto Iglesias original score for Parallel Mothers, now that I have caught up with that film finally. Nominated three times before for The Constant Gardener, The Kite Runner, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, longtime collaborator of Pedro Almodovar. That's one I'd like to see happen for him.
Yeah, and I'll just, you know, repeat more Power of the Dog love in that category. For me, it's the Johnny Greenwood score that I'll be pulling for.
Yeah, I wouldn't complain at all if that was the choice. It was my pick, in fact, for best score in our CFCA ballots, as it was yours. Our Oscar choices, we'd love to hear your picks. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. Josh, that is our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, you can find us at FilmSpotting and at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. That's also where you can vote in the Sweet 16 round of Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 1970s. 64 films enter, only one remains. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in wide release this weekend, is it UMMA, Josh?
I'm not sure about that. U-M-M-A.
U-M-M-A. Okay. After receiving her mother's remains from Korea, Sandra Oh's Amanda becomes haunted by the fear that she'll turn into her mother. X is also out. This is the latest from a filmmaker who has appeared on the show before, made one of my favorite horror films of the past 15, 20 years, The House of the Devil, director Ty West. He also made The Innkeepers. That movie is X, starring Mia Goth. On digital, the new one from Adrian Lyne. Yes, Adrian Lyne, Deep Water, Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas star. Lyne, of course, the director of 9.5 Weeks, Indecent Proposal, and Fatal Attraction. He's bringing the sexy back, Josh. We also...
Thanks for confirming that.
We also can see Master, your Golden Brick recommended film on Amazon Prime. And we can see the new one from director Charlie McDowell, Windfall, the Hitchcockian film Windfall, that will inspire our top five next week as we will share our top five Hitchcockian films.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.